Emergency crews on scene. And Sears Point, eastbound 37 before the Petaluma River Bridge. It's a two-vehicle crash blocking the right lane. Lori Sanders for KQED.
Thank you, Lori. Support for KQED's car donation program comes from local Kia dealers, offering the all-electric Kia EV6 with up to 320 horsepower and an EPA estimated range of 310 miles. More at Kia.com.
Bruce Springsteen became the person who I went to for all my wisdom. There's a song you'll know, Born to Run. And in Born to Run, he says this line where he says, I want to know if love is wild. I want to know if love is real. And that was a really important question to me. Is love real for somebody like me?
Join us for stories of childhood, the joy, the heartache, and the music. That's next time on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
The Moth at 11. And speaking of music, the Right Now-ish podcast features the stories of one Bay Area bassist and composer who connects jazz and hip-hop. Check it out wherever you get your podcasts. This is KQED San Francisco and KQEI North Highlands Sacramento. We're live online at KQED.org and always on the KQED app. It's 8 o'clock.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. The U.S. Supreme Court still has a lot of work ahead for this summer.
And the court's conservatives, especially the Chief Justice, have written the fewest, meaning they likely have lots more majority opinions getting ready to drop.
We'll let you know what to watch for. And the European Union is holding elections this weekend as the threat of political violence spreads in Europe. Plus, today is the birthday of one of the world's most beloved ducks. Donald Duck turns 90. It's Sunday, June 9th. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. President Biden visited an American military cemetery outside Paris today to honor thousands of U.S. soldiers killed during World War I. Biden said he couldn't imagine coming all the way to France and not stopping there to pay his respects. In 2018, then-President Donald Trump declined to visit the cemetery during a trip to France. At that time, the White House cited bad weather. Trump will hold a rally in Las Vegas today, his first since his historic conviction. NPR's Claudia Grisales reports.
President Biden won the state in 2020 in a nail-biter, and Nevada remains a battleground this year as polls predict an even tighter race between Biden and former President Donald Trump. Trump supporter Shiani Santana says she's frustrated. Her family's community in Hawaii, devastated by fires in Maui last year, have not seen more federal assistance. She and other Nevada voters say access to housing, the economy, and immigration remain top issues at the ballot box. Claudia Grisales, NPR News, Las Vegas.
Gaza's health ministry today raised the death toll from yesterday's Israeli operation in Gaza. It says 274 Palestinians were killed. The raid was successful in rescuing four hostages held by Hamas. NPR's Daniel Estrin has more.
They were all captured on October 7th when Hamas launched this war. They were captured from the Nova Music Festival. One of the most well-known of them was 26-year-old Noah Argemani. She was filmed as she was being taken on a motorcycle by Hamas into Gaza. She was calling out for help. Her mother, who was born in China, is hospitalized in Israel with advanced cancer, and she had been pleading to see her daughter while she is still alive.
NPR's Daniel Estrin reporting from Tel Aviv. A missile has struck a cargo ship in the Gulf of Aden in a suspected attack by Houthi rebels in Yemen. NPR's Robbie Griffiths reports from London. The British Maritime Authorities reported that the strike had caused a fire on the ship.
According to private security firm Ambre, a missile hit the Antigua and Barbuda flagged cargo ship's front section late on Saturday, starting a fire that crew were able to put out. A second missile reportedly fired at the ship and missed, while some people on board small boats nearby also opened fire on the ship. No one on board was hurt. Suspicion of the attack fell on the Houthis, though they have not claimed credit. They say they're supporting the Palestinians, though often target vessels that have nothing to do with the conflict in Gaza. According to the US Maritime Administration, the Houthis have launched more than 50 attacks on shipping in the Red Sea since November, killing three sailors, seizing one vessel and sinking another. Robbie Griffiths, NPR News, London.
And you're listening to NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Natalia Navarro. Some legal experts say a court order to temporarily halt a system-wide UC academic worker strike sets a dangerous precedent. On Friday, a Superior Court judge granted a temporary restraining order to the University of California, pausing the strike by thousands of academic workers who walked out over the UC's response to pro-Palestinian protesters. The California Public Employment Relations Board had twice denied UC's request to stop the strike. Vina Dubal is a law professor at UC Irvine. She says the judge should have left the decision to the board.
I think that more and more corporations, employers will feel emboldened to not defer to the agency and go straight to court where they're more likely to get what they want.
In a statement, UC said it's grateful for a pause in the strike so students can complete their academic studies. More than 50,000 Californians died prematurely due to exposure to wildfire smoke between 2008 and 2018. That's according to a study out this week from UCLA scientists. The study states that fine particles the fires release into the air are linked to many health problems like dementia and heart disease. Los Angeles County saw the most deaths due to smoke exposure. Sonoma, Santa Clara, Contra Costa, and Alameda counties also saw more than 2,000 premature deaths each over the 11-year period. More news online at kqed.org. I'm Natalia Navarro.
Support comes from Paint Care. Leftover paint can be dropped off and recycled at nearly 800 sites in California. PaintCare.org. Support for NPR comes from Yarl and Pamela Moan, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts, and the listeners and supporters and members of KQED. The National Weather Service says we can expect sunshine today after morning clouds and temperatures just a little bit warmer with upper 60s, 66 expected for a high in San Francisco, 71 in Oakland, 79 in San Jose, 79 also expected in Napa today, 88. What an interesting temperature discrepancy between Napa and Sonoma County, 88 in Sonoma County, 79 in Napa. Also 80 degrees expected in Concord today and 89 in Sacramento.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Presidential immunity, abortion, guns. The Supreme Court is considering a lot of important cases this term, and now that it's the month of June, it's time for the court to issue some rulings. Joining me now to talk about the decisions we're waiting on is NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. Hi, Nina.
Hi there, Aisha.
So let's start out with a broad overview. How has this term compared with others?
Well, let's put it this way. I make a list of the big cases every term at this time of year. Normally, by this time, there are somewhere between 4 and 6 big cases that have not been decided yet. But this year, there are, that's the drum roll, 16 cases.
And while that's a lot.
Yeah, and while the court almost always finishes its work by the end of June, I think this year the justices will go into July.
And among those big 16 cases this term, what's the biggest one?
Probably it's the case testing Trump's claim of immunity from criminal charges for his attempts to overturn Biden's electoral victory in 2020. It is undoubtedly the most important test of presidential power since the Supreme Court's 1974 decision ordering President Nixon to turn over to the Watergate special prosecutor specific, and it turned out incriminating, tape recordings of his White House conversations. Trump's also implicated in a second case involving the January 6th riot at the Capitol, this one involving a federal statute that makes it a crime to obstruct an official proceeding. It's the most serious offense charged against many of the rioters, and it's one of the charges against Trump, too. Aside from those cases, I would say the other biggest cases are two involving abortion, two important gun control cases, and a raft of regulatory cases in which business interests are asking the Supreme Court to limit the federal government's regulatory powers.
What are those two abortion cases about?
In one, an anti-abortion group is challenging the FDA's rules for prescribing and dispensing abortion pills. Since the court struck down Roe v. Wade 2 years ago, more than half the women terminating pregnancies in this country use pills, and anti-abortion groups are trying to limit the pill's availability. The other abortion case involves a federal law aimed at ensuring that hospitals don't turn away patients needing emergency care, and specifically whether the law requires abortions when needed to save not just the mother's life, but also her health.
And the gun cases?
Well, one involves a federal law making gun possession a crime for anyone subject to a domestic violence court order. That statute is being challenged, as is the federal ban on so-called bump stocks, which can convert legal semi-automatic guns into illegal machine guns that can fire up to 800 rounds in a minute.
You also mentioned the raft of regulatory cases the court will decide. Tell us more about these.
This all involves what the right calls the administrative state. And this Supreme Court, with a conservative supermajority that includes three Trump appointees, has been very receptive to many such challenges. The biggest of these this term seeks to overturn something called Chevron deference. That doctrine, adopted by the court 40 years ago, says that if the meaning of a statute is ambiguous, courts should defer to the regulator's interpretation of the law, the idea being that agencies have the expertise to fill in the gaps to carry out broad congressional mandates. If the court abandons that doctrine, and there's every indication it will, it's hard to wrap your head around all the ways that regulators would be stymied, from air and water pollution regulations to federal rules on health and food safety, just to name a couple of them.
So, Nina, are there clues about what's going to happen in all these cases you've talked about?
Well, we know that the court has not decided roughly half the cases it has before it, including almost all of the most controversial cases. And if you look at the numbers as to which justices have written the most and which justices have written the fewest number of opinions, you can see that the two more senior liberal justices have written the most, meaning they may not have many more majority opinions to write, only dissents. And the court's conservatives, especially the Chief Justice, have written the fewest, meaning they likely have lots more majority opinions getting ready to drop. None of this is good news for the court's liberals. In fact, in a moment of unusual candor, Justice Sonia Sotomayor recently told an audience at Harvard that there are days that I've come to my office after an announcement of a case and closed my door and cried. And there are likely to be more of those days, she said.
That's NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Aisha.
The Israeli military is operating in Rafah. That's the city in Gaza's south, the site of the border crossing with Egypt through which much of the international food aid passes. That crossing is closed now, making what was already a humanitarian crisis worse. NPR's Jane Arath and Anis Baba report on how one U.S. aid organization is coping.
Huge pots of stock simmer at one of the new Rebuilding Alliance kitchens, relocated from Rafah to Deir al-Bala in central Gaza. NPR's Anas Baba asks chef Hassan Ayash about that day's dish. It's macaroni, he says. No, there's no protein, just macaroni. They're trying hard, but it's nothing like the network of kitchens they had in Rafah. There, the small aid organization, with the help of the UN's World Food Program, was dishing out eggplant and chickpea stew, rice, and fresh bread. Over the 21 years it has operated in Gaza, Rebuilding Alliance has created a network of aid kitchens, many of them focused on employing women. After the Gaza War started, as malnutrition spread, it managed to serve 100,000 meals a day. Many of those were in Rafah. Last month, Israel, saying it needed to root out the militant group Hamas, took control of the Rafah border crossing, and aid stopped coming through. Then Israel started bombing. Rafiq al-Mahdoun is the Rebuilding Alliance program manager.
We moved our stock from our warehouse to more safer areas. We distributed it to the cooking points in order not to keep big quantities in one place. The other thing, we wanted to keep our people safe. For that reason, we asked them to move.
Here, many of the staff live in homemade tents. There's a dangerous shortage of drinking water. Even if people had food to cook, there's very little fuel to cook it with. Rebuilding Alliance is using compressed wood it receives from World Central Kitchen. In Rafah, groups of women mixed dough and rolled it out to bake fresh bread with every meal. But here, Al-Mahdoun says, there isn't enough fuel. Like most aid groups now, Rebuilding Alliance has formed partnerships to take advantage of a patchwork of supplies.
One of our partners managed to get 3 tons of salt and 6 tons of vegetable oil. But we need another ingredients to make food.
Although Israel reopened a small border crossing, it's used mainly for commercial traders rather than aid trucks. Vegetables are now for sale in the markets here. But Al-Mahdoun says not many people can afford them.
We need lentils, we need peas, we need wheat flour, we need rice, we need bread, we need vegetables, we need everything.
Al-Mahdoun said they were serving about 55,000 meals a day. But now, a week later, that's almost doubled. And their biggest Rafah kitchen has reopened in Deir el-Bala. Apart from hunger and lack of shelter, he says the biggest impact for families displaced over and over is what it has done to their spirits.
I see people who just move but are not concentrating or focusing on anything. If you ask them, what do you need? He say, I don't know. What is your plan? I don't know. What do you like to help you? He say, I don't know.
At one of the relocated kitchens, Nahya Ayash, known as Tahsin, was trying to build the cooking facilities back up despite the lack of supplies or equipment. When she fled Rafah, she took 5 cooking pots with her. She burned the family photo albums in case Israeli soldiers entered their house. She says after seeing social media posts of soldiers displaying women's lingerie from homes they had entered, she did not want them looking at family photos of women.
I burned my personal pictures in case someone comes into my house and does something bad to them. It was a very difficult feeling to burn your memories.
And then she packed up her pots and left for Deir el-Bala. There's nothing you can do but keep living, she says. That and help others to survive. Jane Araf, NPR News, Amman.
You're listening to NPR News.
Support for KQED comes from European Sleepworks, the store that bases its design and materials on research factors affecting sleep, including comfort and support, humidity levels, and ease of breathing. Details online about their mattresses and bedding at sleepworks.com.
and Star One Credit Union. Members can safely send or receive money in just seconds, 24/7, with Star One's Instant Pay, online or on Star One's app. Star One Credit Union in your best interest. StarOne.org.
There's a nasty illness spread by ticks that's on the rise in the Northeast and Midwest United States.
It does seem to be following the trend of Lyme disease and entering into areas where Lyme disease is prevalent.
But scientists are on the case. They're starting clinical trials to come up with a treatment. Learn more Monday on Morning Edition from NPR News.
That's tomorrow morning, beginning at 2 a.m. Morning Edition every weekday morning from 2 until 9 here on KQED Public Radio.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Gaza's health ministry said today at least 274 Palestinians were killed yesterday during the Israeli raid that rescued four hostages who had been kidnapped by Hamas in October. Israel blames Hamas for the casualties because the hostages were being held in a civilian neighborhood. President Biden and the First Lady wrapped up their visit to France today with a visit to an American cemetery. They paid their respects to thousands of U.S. soldiers and Marines killed during World War I. And the trial of Hunter Biden resumes in Wilmington, Delaware tomorrow. The president's son is charged with violating federal gun laws. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from StoryWorth. Each week, StoryWorth emails a loved one a question about their life. After a year, they'll publish family memories into a bound book to keep forever. Learn more at StoryWorth.com. And the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing a transformative approach to justice that is community-led, restorative, and racially just. Learn more at PublicWelfare.org. And the listeners of KQED. Well, looking ahead, it looks like Tuesday will be the warmest day of the week. Today, slightly warmer than yesterday. Sunshine expected after morning clouds, 60s to upper 80s in Sacramento.
This week in addition from NPR News, I'm Aisha Roscoe. A look now at the economy, the nation's and yours. Businesses are hiring, unemployment is low, but many Americans say they're grumpy about their finances, and that could be a big factor in this year's election. NPR's chief economics correspondent Scott Horsley joins us now. Good morning.
Great to be with you, Aisha.
So, Scott, we know inflation has a lot to do with people's unhappiness with the economy. When I go out to eat or go to the grocery store, prices are still high. A Red Baron pizza used to be $5, now it's $7. So what is going on?
Well, you're right. Inflation has come down a lot since it hit that four-decade high a couple of years ago. It was above 9% back then. It's under 3.5% now. We're going to find out about May's cost of living this coming week. But there hasn't been a lot of progress on inflation in the last few months. Now, there is some encouraging news at the gas pump. Gas prices dropped by 8 cents a gallon this past week. That's the biggest decrease all year. And we know that gas prices have an outsized impact on people's feelings about the economy. So we'll see if cheaper gasoline helps people get out of that funk they've been in.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely nice to see gasoline prices come down, especially as people are traveling for the summer. But a lot of other things still seem really expensive.
You're right. Grocery prices have pretty much leveled off, but they're not going down for the most part. And the price of restaurant meals is still climbing by about 4% per year. Now, businesses do say they're getting more pushback from customers who have hit their limit on spending. More shoppers are hunting for bargains, and some businesses are responding with more discounts. Applebee's, for example, reintroduced its $1 margarita. And more than a quarter of all Applebee's customers are now taking advantage of some kind of promotion when they order. So people are getting more price conscious. Companies have to think twice about raising prices because they know they risk losing business when they do so. And by the way, that is normal. That's how the economy usually works. What was abnormal was the situation we've had in recent years when companies raise prices at will and shoppers just kept buying.
$1 margarita sounds like party time to me. But one thing that's not getting a discount is house prices. They are still going up, and we might need some margaritas if we end up going house hunting.
Yeah, and that's a big concern, especially for people trying to buy their first house. There aren't a lot of homes on the market, so prices are high, and then there's the double whammy of high interest rates on top of that. A new survey from Fannie Mae this past week showed just 14% of people think this is a good time to buy a home. Mortgage rates did inch down a little bit this past week, but they're still pretty close to 7%.
So what's it going to take to get lower interest rates? I thought I heard they were going to start getting those down a bit.
The Federal Reserve has signaled it wants to see more progress on inflation before it starts cutting interest rates. Some other central banks in Europe and Canada did start cutting rates this past week, but the Fed's expected to stand pat when policymakers meet on Wednesday. Borrowing costs are likely to stay high at least through the summer, and that means it's going to remain costly to get a car loan or borrow money for a business or just carry a balance on your credit card. We could start to see some relief from those high interest rates in September, but it's going to depend on what happens with inflation and the job market between now and then.
But the job market still looks pretty good, right?
It does. The Labor Department reported Friday that employers added 272,000 jobs in May, a lot more than forecasters had expected. Average wages were also up 4.1% over the last year, which is more than enough to keep pace with inflation. That strong job market's a double-edged sword, though. It's good for workers, but those big wage gains could put upward pressure on prices, and that makes it that much harder for the Fed to get prices under control so it feels confident about cutting interest rates.
NPR's Scott Horsley, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Voting for the European Union's parliament wraps up today, and it's been a campaign season marked by violence. An attack in Slovakia, a beating in Germany, just Friday a body check to Denmark's prime minister, who had just been campaigning with her party's leading EU candidate. As Willem Marx reports, extremist rhetoric online may be to blame. And heads up, you'll hear some gunshots in about 10 seconds.
As Slovakia's Prime Minister Robert Fico greeted passers-by behind a metal barrier in mid-May, several shots suddenly rang out. Bodyguards bundled his slumped body into a vehicle and raced to the ER. Police pinned his assailant to the floor. The attack shocked Europe. The leader of an EU government left fighting for his life. Fico has since then recovered slowly, and with his country deeply polarized, he now blames his political opponents for the actions of a 71-year-old shooter. The incident raised questions not just about his personal security, though, but the level of anger directed against politicians across the continent. Just 2 weeks later, in Germany, an immigrant from Afghanistan stabbed members of a self-described anti-Islam movement. The man fought several police with his blade before himself being shot. Also in May, four teenagers had attacked another German politician, a centre-left member of the European Parliament who ended up in hospital. Evidence such violence cuts across political lines. These incidents may not seem related, but experts say several common but complex factors are driving attacks against politicians. They include the internet and increased migration. And now, a Middle East conflict that echoes across European cities, too. Online, the pervasive presence of right-wing extremism has changed the way attackers choose their targets, says Jakob Ravendal, an associate professor at Norway's Police University College.
The far right has a more individual-oriented targeting, and in that sense also they are often not necessarily going for mass casualty attacks, although a few have, but there's also been these much more targeted attacks punishing politicians for their liberal immigration policies, for instance.
He says online communities form a crucial component.
Definitely contributes to the targeting process. So who's ending up as the targets? There, I think social media plays an important role, both in the attacks targeting politicians, but also more generally, who's seen as sort of legitimate target groups.
In the past 2 months, police in Hungary, France and Sweden have foiled potential terror plots. But Germany is at the center of this seeming spike in political victims of violence, in part because of its past.
Germany has a special history because of its ties to National Socialism, as well as the horrific deeds the Germans did in the Second World War.
Jan Rathje researches right-wing German nationalism at the Center for Monitoring, Analysis and Strategy and says the more recent German history of welcoming migrants could be one reason a tiny fraction of extremists do now take angry action against elected officials.
We have an increase also in hate speech, racist hate speech, anti-immigration hate speech online, and this might be something that is connected to people perceiving migration as an existential threat to their existence and the existence of Germany, which might lead them to violent acts.
As a war of aggression in Ukraine rages on at Europe's border, inside this democratic continent, societal conflicts over ideas and identity no longer simply clash in the political realm, but sometimes in the real, physical world of blood and bullets, too. For NPR News, I'm Willem Marks.
Happy birthday to you! Happy birthday, dear Donald!
One of America's most beloved birds turns 90 years old today, and I must say he's one of the only birds that I actually like. Donald Duck hatched from Walt Disney Studios on June 9, 1934, when he starred in the cartoon short The Wise Little Hen, and supposedly learned the value of hard work. Whether or not Donald Duck actually internalized that lesson is debatable. But one thing is for sure, he's nested securely inside the hearts of millions of people around the world. J.B. Kaufman is a film historian who's written several books on Disney films. He joins us now from Wichita, Kansas. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
The words that come to mind when people think of Donald Duck are angry, lazy, easily frustrated, and of course, pretty hard to understand. Was he always like that?
Almost from the beginning, yes. His violent temper surfaced for the first time in his second screen appearance, which was a Mickey Mouse short called Orphan's Benefit. He was provoked into losing his temper and threw a mighty tantrum that went over big with audiences. Mickey Mouse was, and of course still is, the real figurehead of the Disney studio. But by the mid-30s, he had been pretty well typed as a nice guy. And that meant that there were a lot of things that he couldn't do in a cartoon. He would never provoke a fight or anything like that. Well, Donald Duck didn't have any restrictions like that. His bad temper came to the surface right away. And I think Walt kind of got a kick out of that. So he encouraged that kind of bad behavior in Donald.
And what about the voice?
Well, that came from a man named Clarence Nash. From an early age, he had shown a real knack for doing animal imitations. And in fact, he'd already been doing freelance work for the Disney studio, coming in to record bird calls and various animal sounds for the soundtracks of the cartoons. So much that he kind of developed a parlor trick of putting on this baby goat's voice and reciting Mary Had a Little Lamb. Walt heard this, and where Nash was picturing a goat, Walt heard a talking duck.
Well, let's move on to the 1940s when Donald Duck moonlighted in wartime films like Donald Gets Drafted. How did he end up in these propaganda films?
Well, those were the times. You know, Mickey Mouse was such a nice guy that he was really nobody's idea of a fighting man. And he kind of disappeared from cartoons for the duration of the war. But Donald was, he definitely had a warlike spirit. You just heard him volunteering to join the army and be a flyer. But then when he actually is in the service, he realizes right away that this is not a glamorous life. He has the same kind of drudgery routine that other GIs had.
We also found Donald Duck in the short educational film Donald in Math Magic Land.
Mathematics? That's for all kids.
Eggheads? Now hold on, Donald. You like music, don't you?
What?
Well, without eggheads, there would be no music.
That was yet another place where Donald's less than perfect character really served him well, because he started out as a reluctant student. And then the idea is that he goes through this experience and starts to see how fascinating mathematics can be, and it kind of brings the audience along with him.
So what's Donald Duck like nowadays? I know he's in the new version of DuckTales.
He hasn't changed a lot. I think if there has been a change, it's been to make him, let's say, more family friendly. A lot of Donald's cartoons have very sharp, pointed, sophisticated humor. When it comes to characters like Donald, I think the company is aiming for more of a gentle kind of cuddlier version of Donald, so that he won't offend anybody. But the raw temper and everything, you can still spot that. That's still there. There's a great quote from Walt Disney. He's a composite of all the people you don't like and a few of the people you do.
That's J.B. Kaufman. He is a film historian. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure talking with you about this.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Live from KQBD News, I'm Natalia Navarro. A long-awaited light rail extension connecting East San Jose to BART is now officially under construction. KQBD's Juan Carlos Lara reports from the groundbreaking ceremony yesterday.
The 2.4-mile expansion will extend the Santa Clara Valley Transportation Authority's Orange Line by two stops, providing East San Jose residents with a route to Milpitas where they can transfer to BART.
2.5 miles may not sound like much.
That's San Jose Mayor Matt Mahan.
But if you've ever taken a walk in the hot sun with a bag of groceries in one hand and a child in the other, you know that this connector will be life-changing.
The project is decades in the making. Voters approved a tax measure in 2000 that provided $313 million of the project's funding. But political leaders at the groundbreaking say it was a constant battle to secure further funding and prevent the project from being abandoned. Danny Garza, president of the Plata Arroyo Neighborhood Association, says the east side of San Jose, which is a heavily Latina area, has suffered from decades of underinvestment.
Race has always been a role here in the East Valley. Why do you think we're 24 years late? It's because the other people on the other side of town, I don't care what race they are, I don't care what color they are, they ignored the families in the East Valley. That's not going to happen anymore.
The project will add two new stations at Story Road and East Ridge Transit Center. Construction is expected to take 4 years to complete. I'm Juan Carlos Lara, KQED News.
And I'm Natalia Navarro.
Support comes from Paint Care. Leftover paint can be dropped off and recycled at nearly 800 sites in California. PaintCare.org. It's time now for our perspective. That's our listener commentary series. As a second-generation Asian American, it was much easier for Knives Nguyen to come out to their friends at school than to their mom. Why our media brings their perspective.
Do you know what a bisexual person is? With a racing heart and a lump in my throat, I told her, "That's who I am." I came out to my mom in middle school. Even though she immigrated here from Vietnam as a teenager and speaks perfect English, I wasn't sure if she had ever heard of the term bisexual before. Like my sexuality, my life has always felt split in two. Who I get to be when I'm at school and who I am when I'm at home. In high school, I was openly queer and supported our small but mighty gay community. But at home, My exploration of androgyny was met with hostility from my father and disappointment from my mother. One especially tense day, my father told me I needed to change how I looked or else he would throw out all of my clothes and replace them with skirts and dresses. A female gender was a performance I had to keep up at home, and I was failing. Hair was another source of conflict in my family. I've always preferred a shorter hairstyle, but my mom always hesitated taking me to the salon. My short hair was ugly to them. As I grew older and less dependent on my parents, hiding my new haircuts became a necessity. I struggled to reconcile my identity with their expectations. I understand their harshness, influenced by Vietnamese cultural norms where LGBT topics are taboo. In a way, their concern was an attempt to protect me. When you live in a society that preaches anti-gay rhetoric, you too will find yourself speaking the same language. Many queer Asian Americans face similar struggles, navigating often queerphobic cultural expectations and personal identities. Yet, we are still our immigrant parents' wildest dreams. We are capable of greatness regardless of who we love or how we express ourselves. With a perspective, I'm Knives Nguyen.
Knives Nguyen is 18 years old and a student at UC Berkeley. Their perspective was produced by YR Media. Support for Perspectives comes from Comcast, dedicated to serving California communities with access to high-speed internet and digital equity initiatives to help people get online and participate in the digital economy. More at california.comcast.com.
I'm Peter Sagal, and a huge surprise this week, Boeing launched a spacecraft into orbit. That's it. That's the surprise. Join us for the news quiz that never malfunctions. That's Wait, Wait from NPR.
Wait, wait, don't tell me. That comes your way at 10 o'clock this morning here on KQED Public Radio, the Moth Radio Hour. That's at 11, the New Yorker Radio Hour at noon, and City Arts Lectures at 1 o'clock this afternoon features guest Amy Tan talking about her new book, which she wrote and illustrated about birds.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Today is the final day of voting in the European parliamentary elections. Voters across the European Union are choosing representatives for a five-year term. Far-right parties are hoping to expand their influence. South Korea today resumed the broadcast of anti-North Korea messages in border areas. This is in response to North Korea sending balloons filled with trash into South Korea in the past few weeks. And Donald Trump is holding a political rally today after a New York jury found the former president guilty of 34 felonies. The rally is in Las Vegas, where the National Weather Service expects the temperature could be as high as 111 degrees. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Capital One, offering their travel card venture. What's in your wallet terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at Viking.com. And the listeners and supporters and members of KQED. 66 expected for high in San Francisco today, 71 in Oakland, 79 once again expected in San Jose and in the Napa Valley, 88 in Sonoma County, and we expect a high of 89 degrees in Sacramento.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Jasmine Williams knows she should feel good about moving into a new community, but it's making her pretty uneasy. She, her husband, and their young son have left a small Los Angeles apartment behind for the recently developed suburb called Liberty. It's an all-black community with big, beautiful houses and good schools, no police profiling, no stereotyping, a safe place promoting black excellence and well-being. The residents of Liberty are so happy, maybe too happy. That's the plot of Nicola Yoon's new novel, One of Our Kind, and she's here now to talk about it. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Tell us a bit more about Jasmine and what led her and her family to settle in Liberty.
Yeah, so she wanted to move to Liberty for safety. for community. She has a young Black son. She's pregnant. Her husband is Black. And moving to a community where everyone is Black and there's a sense of physical safety and psychic safety that she wants for her children. It's a very, very wealthy place. She thinks that that wealth could be protective, and certainly her husband does. And so that's why she goes.
And Liberty, you know, has a lot of this self-care services. And that's kind of, you know, loaded in the book, but they have the wellness center. But Jasmine seems to view self-care as selling out.
She does.
Which I thought was very interesting. Talk to me about that.
Right. I mean, I think there's a way in which we can all feel conflicted about like the modern world we live in, right? Mm-hmm. Because so many things are wrong. And there's a way in which you can feel guilty about not doing enough all the time, right? I mean, there's global warming, but we still all fly on planes and we all have phones and the labor practices around making them certainly aren't great, right? And so there's a hypocrisy that we all have to live with all the time. And, you know, Jasmine is a public defender, so she certainly is doing the work, as it were, and she wants to make sure that she's always trying to make the world a better place. And she does that sometimes maybe to her own detriment, but she is, you know, her heart is in a good place anyway.
You know, we get into a lot of hair stuff. So I wanted to ask you, because she's kind of judgy.
Kind of judgy. She's so judgy.
She's so judgy. And she really is like of this mindset that if you have an afro, it's a go. No afro, no go.
Yeah, I wanted to explore all the ways in which we put ourselves into a box and the ways in which society puts us into a box, right? Because the fact is, Jasmine moves to Liberty and assumes that all the Black people are going to be the same as her, right? Mm. Which is, of course not. Like, we're not a monolith. There's a way in which, like, the overall system forces you to put yourself into different boxes, too. And we are victims of it and sometimes perpetrators of it. And I think that is where you see Jasmine being sort of judgmental. And sometimes she pulls back from that. And can see that she's doing this thing that everyone else has done to her too.
No spoilers, but I mean, there are these places in the novel where you do think, you know, Jasmine, you know, get your son, get your pregnant self, get out of there. You know, is part of this an exploration of how comfort, right? Like being in the gated community, being in this place, can dull your senses to the dangers that exist in the world?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of classic thriller form, right? I really wanted to write a thriller. Like, I wanted to keep you up all night, right? And then you get to the end and you go, holy crap. And then I want you to call your friends and talk about, like, why the book ended that way. And I did want to say, like, look at this world that we have created and what it does, like, the way it can pretzel us and, like, you know, contort us into missing things that are right in front of us, but sort of in classic thriller fashion too. You know, there's a lot of love in her life, and I think love can make you accept a lot of things, forgive a lot of things, right? I have certainly made mistakes for love before.
Mm-hmm. Now, it will make you make some huge mistakes because you will blind you. So what led you to write this book in the first place? What were you feeling when you were writing this book?
There are a few things that led to the book. The first is this conversation I had with a friend of mine, and we had done this panel on race and racism. And then afterwards we'd gone to dinner and we were drinking wine. He's Black as well. And he said to me, do I ever wonder who I'd be or who we'd be as people if it weren't for the specter of race and racism? It's a big question. That's a great question, but it's also an impossible question, right? Like, there isn't really an answer to that. Like, it's hard to tease apart who you would be if suddenly everything were different, right? And then there's this Toni Morrison quote that's been in my head since I was a kid, when she says, the very real function of racism is distraction. It causes us to, like, have to prove over and over again our reason for being, right? I'm paraphrasing there. And then there's this podcast that I was listening to once, and it was talking about The Stepford Wives and how everyone misremembers that book because we use that term, she's such a Stepford wife, to like beat women over the head, like to say they're robotic or whatever. But actually the book is really super feminist and it's such an indictment of the men who would want this thing for their wives, right? And so it was all of those things and just all of these questions that came together in my mind.
You know, in the end, like when you're thinking about all these questions and thinking about this book, which is really about like how we define ourselves, obviously I don't, you know, we're not going to give nothing away. Did you come to any conclusions about identity and what does define us as individuals?
Yeah, I mean, I think what defines us is the constant interrogating of that and just trying to love, which sounds Pollyanna-ish, but actually isn't, right? I mean, to like really be in the world is an act of like resistance and to just pay attention. Like I'm married to the love of my life. I have this great kid and I try to hold on to them and be who they see me as. And I try to hold on to that, right? I cannot cede my joy to someone else's perception of me that's based on nothing, right? I know who I am. I know I'm a good mom. I know I'm a good wife. I'm an okay writer.
You're a great writer. You know, you're a great writer. You make a living at it. Very few people can do that. So
I get to have this job, right? Like we get to define ourselves, I think. But what I really want is for people to talk to each other after and to sort of listen to each other with a sense of grace. Because I think one of the things that is missing from our discourse is grace. And I think that we need more of that in the sort of national discourse.
That's Nicola Yoon. Her new novel is One of Our Kind. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on.
Think about the Harlem Renaissance and you may think of writers like Langston Hughes, W.E.B. Du Bois, and Zora Neale Hurston. But a new exhibit at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City is giving visual artists their due. Later today on All Things Considered, how those artists help change how we look at Black life. Listen to that story on your radio or by telling your smart speaker to play your member station by name. An aging king who's won the respect and commanded the fear of his court for decades is nearing the end of his reign. A power struggle of succession is emerging. No, I'm not talking about the latest spinoff to Game of Thrones.
What is a king without his kingdom? What is the king without his property? He's free.
That's King George Coulomb. He runs the largest Renaissance fair in the country, about 55 miles outside of Houston. Lance Oppenheim followed him and his sometimes less than merry band of employees in the new three-part docuseries Renfair, streaming on Max. How fare thee, Lance?
Fare thee well. Thank you. Thanks. Thank you for having me on this. This is it's an honor. I'm still nailing down my Renaissance speak.
So am I. Let's start with this guy, George, who calls himself King. Who is he?
George is, I guess, for the lack of the better words, this is what someone describes him in the series, a self-made king. I don't know how many there are out there in America, probably very few, but this is a man who created the largest Renaissance fair in the country. It got so large that he decided to incorporate a city around the fair. And in that city, he became the mayor of everyone around him. Everyone votes for him every single year. And so in a way, he created a real life fiefdom of which he has been the sole ruler of for the last 5 decades. And now that he's about 87 years old, he's trying to figure out what to do with the rest of his life. Can he live without it? And in that sense, I think this whole story becomes in some ways less about just a Renaissance fair and who's going to be the next person in charge, but it actually ends up becoming a very relatable and familiar, I think, American story, you know, about a leader of advanced age running an institution they helped shape, having trouble letting go.
How did you come in contact with them and decide to make this documentary?
Well, I can't take the full credit for discovering him. There are two amazing journalists that came to me with the discovery of George. One of them, his name was David Govey Herbert. He's an amazing long-form nonfiction writer. And his story researcher, Abigail Rowe, they were the two people that discovered the universe that George created. And when they came to me, we all thought we were going to tell a somewhat farcical story, a comedy of sorts, a succession crisis happening at a sort of absurd place at a Renaissance fair. But as we spent over, you know, almost 3 years and shot 100 days there, what became a comedy turned into a tragedy. And I think that's what you'll end up seeing by the end.
Well, we find out a lot about George and other key players pretty early on. And one thing that's clear about George is just how much people seem to respect him.
I pray two things in my life. God and King George. I am here because of one man who had a vision to do this. To me, he will live forever.
I was at the right place at the right time and met King George. And he allowed me to put sausage on a stick.
He's the ruler.
I've never seen him treat anyone unfairly. He fired me with plenty of cause.
Where do you think that respect comes from? And do you think it's a fearful respect or a loving respect?
I think it's certainly the former. I think George has created a culture of fear around him. You know, for years, for decades, I think he was a much more benevolent ruler. But as he's aged, I think he's become a lot more petulant and mercurial. And because George created the largest Renaissance festival in the country, the most financially successful festival in the country, a lot of people, their livelihoods and their lives have been devoted to the culture of this place that he created. And if you get on his bad side, if you insult him, if you're not wearing the proper garment, if you're not wearing a hat on the fairground and he catches you, if your booth is not selling products he likes, he will bulldoze your booth and he will kick you out as quick as you can sneeze.
We don't want to give anything away, but there seems to be a clear successor by the end of the series. And what the audience sees is very cinematic. How were some of these scenes filmed? Like were there reenactments? Like they do seem like very stylized.
Well, we're calling the series a docu-fantasia, and the reason we're doing so is because, to me, every single thing in this is a collaboration with every person in the series itself. When you're making a documentary that features reenactors in a reenactment theme park, I think, you know, it was important to me as a storyteller to carry over the magic and the sort of theatrical reality that everyone hews to there in the storytelling itself. That isn't to say, though, that the events that you're seeing are constructed. I mean, I'm working, again, with two great journalists. Every single moment of this is heavily reported. And even if it sounds absurd, there is an absolute, extremely intensive investigative reporting process to every single moment you see in the film, the corporate drama that unfolds. When you look back to even the history and the beginnings of documentary filmmaking, there is a very, very alive and rich tradition of filmmakers working in collaborative ways with their subjects to not only just document their lives, but also to figure out ways to creatively express elements of their life.
Well, what do you think this series can teach people about power?
To me, I mean, the series is really, it's in a way, it's almost like a portrait of where we are as a country, you know, almost a portrait of American of an American empire in decline. And I try to be positive most days, but I feel like it's not just politically. I see corporate America and show business. I think there's a lot of different institutions that are governed by people of advanced ages that were the magic men, the people that created and imbued so much magic, so much so that they reshaped an entire way of thinking and working. But what happens when you get to a place in your life where you can't let go? If you zoom out a little bit, to me, it almost feels like a miniature of a lot of things that we're experiencing right now culturally.
That's Lance Oppenheim. He's the director of the docuseries Renfair on Max. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor.
Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe.
One more hour of Weekend Edition awaits, and then it's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me at 10 o'clock. Support for NPR comes from the NPR Wine Club, where members can explore wines from around the world, and every purchase supports NPR's high-quality journalism available to adults 21 or older, nprwineclub.org, and FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at fjc.org. And the listeners and supporters and members of KQED. I'm Beth Heisengill. Let's go to traffic again. We're going to go to the, back to the problem in Richmond this morning, get an update. Lori Sanders.
Yes, it's still out there, believe it or not. Eastbound 80 before Richmond Parkway. This happened right around 7:20 this morning. It's a three-vehicle crash. Two cars are still blocking the two right lanes, but it does look like they have the tow trucks now on scene. Traffic's still backed up.